Nowadays, a college education can easily exceed the cost of a house. This hour, a critical assessment of the problems in higher ed. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, Jacques Berlinerblau, the author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. In it, he explains why he thinks the tenure system is falling apart, why he describes PhDs as a formidable but defective product. He also provides a map for parents and students on how to navigate the college landscape. Join us with your questions about how college does or doesn't work. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, my guest is Jacques Berlinerblau, the author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Jacques Berlinerblau is a professor, tenured professor. That's important in this conversation. We'll find out a little bit later. Also, director of the Center for Jewish Civilization at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He joins us for the entire hour. Jacques Berlinerblau, welcome to River to River on Iowa Public Radio.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Iowa.
All right. Great to have you with us. We want to have Iowa participate in this conversation as you listen to what Jacques has to say about higher education. We want to hear from, well, former college students, parents of college students, perhaps prospective college students, professors, of course. Join us with your questions, your observations about how college does or doesn't work these days. I would like to ask you, Jacques, to start off with a little reading about the value of professors and teaching from your book and set it up to the degree that you need to.
All right. So we're going to read from page 70 in Campus Confidential, and maybe I'll give you a paragraph or two. You'll stop me when I need to be stopped, right?
All right. We'll do that.
Here we go. Okay, radio voice. An undergraduate's intellectual, psychological, and dare I say spiritual growth is nourished by many things. Friends, sports, romance, sexual experimentation, parties, tawdry-flavored vodkas, internships, community service, the contemplation of the metaphysical, the enjoyment of art, music, and cinema, and so much else. But ultimately, nothing will validate the massive investment of time and money that is a college education more than a student's encounter with professors. I am speaking of those roughly 1,800 contact hours spent in the company of 30 to 40 teachers.
Okay. Jacques, tell us, you illustrated there the importance of that connection with the teachers, 30 to 40 that you'll have during your college experience. You have many criticisms of teaching in colleges, namely that the star faculty, these are the ones that often lure incoming students to the college, are not necessarily or more often not the ones the student will have much contact with. Explain why that happens and how that's changed.
Yeah. The American academic enterprise is kind of like a campus novel. And I know you've got the Iowa Writers Workshop at the University of Iowa, so I'm very excited to be speaking to people that create fiction. I hope they're listening, Ben. I want to impress them and depress them to a certain degree. The American academic enterprise is all upside down, and we have a peculiar incentivization system whereby the most accomplished professors, as measured by their research accomplishments, spend the least time in the classroom with undergraduates. So when you think of a great university, you think of the great minds, the great researchers, the thought leaders, right? Chances are pretty much nugatory that they will be instructing freshmen and sophomores when fall semester rolls around.
How did this come to be? Explain it, because when we put ourselves a bit in the professor's shoes, the structure that he or she finds himself in, does does not tell him or her teaching is the top priority, right?
Yeah, that's probably it. Somewhere, I mean, the institution of tenure, which we'll be speaking about, was born around 1940. There were fits and starts before that, of course. Somehow, the institution of tenure, the way one granted tenure, which is after 6 years of a probationary period, you essentially have, if you pass all your, if you jump through the hoops and your committees approve you, you have a job for life, full academic freedom, and a pretty decent salary. Somewhere along the way, and I never quite figured out where, we decided that the ticket to achieving tenure status was preternatural accomplishment as a researcher, publishing lots and lots of peer-reviewed scholarly research. And the teaching component, which would grant one tenure or get one tenure, became smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to the point where it's almost become irrelevant, especially at elite schools. So that's one of the ways we got ourselves into this fine fix.
Mm-hmm. I would like to have you listen, have us listen to some voices collected yesterday, or rather last week. An Iowa Public Radio production assistant, Robbie Broad, hit the streets of Iowa City last week to get an idea of how the issue of tenure is felt at the University of Iowa. And as you would have guessed, I think, Jacques, most of the faculty he asked to speak with declined to be interviewed. They said the topic of tenure was too controversial, and they'd rather not discuss it. So all we're going to hear is about 3 minutes of students' voices. He was able to talk with undergraduates to see how much they knew about who leads their classes and whether they feel they're getting enough bang for their buck. Let's have a listen to this collection of voices.
Are you aware of which one of your professors are tenured?
All of my math teachers, they look old. Yeah.
No, to be honest, I am not.
I am very unaware.
No, I'm not.
No. Well, they usually introduce themselves at the very beginning of the classes. But, I think most of the students just don't pay attention to it, so yeah.
So if you had to give a percentage estimate of who's teaching your classes, how many do you think are led by a tenured professor?
I have no idea.
In my particular major, I only took probably 3 or 4 classes that were taught strictly by tenured professors. Some of the intro level courses were taught by tenured professors and then had teaching assistants who helped with group work, but the majority of classes beyond that were taught by just TAs.
I would say around 20% is 10 years, and I would say around 30% is TA, and the others will be like within 10 years.
Yeah. So how many of your classes are led by a TA or graduate student?
Well, all my discussions are, so I'd say around half.
Around about 20%.
I'd say not very many, at least that I know of, but I'm pretty sure there's a few.
For summer, just one of my micro is led by a TA, other all professors.
Probably 70% of my classes.
Do you feel your education is worth the money?
It would not. Yes, but only because it's some of my only options. I don't think it should cost anywhere near this much, but I still think the education is better than not having it, despite the insane amounts of money.
To be honest, yes. I think education is a big part of life. It's what makes you grow and become wiser in life.
Yeah. I got the Hawk tuition grant for the summer, so it's not that expensive.
Yeah, I'd say so, especially since I've worked through residency, so I'm paying in-state tuition now. So out of state's a different story, but in-state, yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, I'd say it's worth the money. Just since we have to put a lot of money into it, we try to get as much as we can out of it with all the things that we have to pay for, like CAM bus, the rec, and all the maintenance and upkeep of the whole university. So I'd say it makes sense.
So do you feel that your education is worth the money?
A very good question. Do you know how much tuition we have to pay for international students?
I am not aware. How much do you have to pay?
So the coming semester is around, Yeah, 17,000, so, which is a lot. I do think that our tuition is a little bit higher comparing to the education we received. But anyway, I appreciate the education and those professors' knowledge. Like I said, the knowledge will be priceless, I would expect. But it's a little bit high for tuition.
Okay, some voices. University of Iowa students collected by Iowa Public Radio production assistant Robbie Broad. In these comments included Camden Kent, Lauren Cheshire, Walter Lynn Erlis, Khalid Kaladi, Daniel Reiner, and international students Dominic and E. Lynn. So, Jacques, what do you think of University of Iowa undergraduate students' assessments of their knowledge we'll focus on tenure a little bit later, but who was teaching them and whether their education was worth all this money?
Yeah, those kids are awesome because they proved my hypothesis. So right there on page, 26 and 27, I pointed out that the typical American undergraduate has absolutely no conception of who is tenured and who is not tenured. And there's a reason for that. It's because it's completely irrelevant to them. So God bless them. The problem is that it's very relevant to us as faculty members, and that disconnect is fascinating to me.
Okay, so fewer tenured professors teaching students, but stepping in for these tenured positions, who's teaching the courses then? We heard TAs are teaching, others non-tenured track professors. Is that necessarily a worse education?
No. That's the great contingent faculty of the United States of America. It's a tragic situation, all right? What's happening is we have a two-tiered structure in American higher education. We're the tenured, and there are fewer and fewer of us, and our ranks are going to get smaller over the next couple of decades. Basically, live the dream. I say live the dream in quotes because all surveys show that they're extremely unhappy and they're depressive, but we can get to that at another point, right? Whereas 70 to 80% of the 1.5 million professors in the United States are non-tenure line. They are called contingent faculty, and they labor under usually deplorable working conditions that make it very, very hard for them to excel in the classroom, but I think they do a wonderful job given the circumstances, and they probably do a better job than most of the tenure line professors.
What do you call deplorable circumstances?
Oh, we have data that indicates that the average adjunct professor in the United States gets $2,500 a course. A quarter of contingent faculty in the United States are living at or beneath the poverty level. They have no job security. They can be fired for a yes or for a no. They have no tenure protections. It's not always that bad, but it's often that bad, as I'm sure many of your contingent faculty listeners will tell us when we take calls.
Okay. Join our conversation with Jacques Berliner-Blau, author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. You know, do you agree with what you're hearing? Do you want to have an observation? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So part of your book talks is sort of this roadmap for prospective students and the parents of prospective students on how to assess colleges. Tell us about the metrics you would advise using to predict which school gives the best undergraduate education.
Sure. It's all about the professors. I think we as professors have to own that, right? A good education is about us. The problem, as I mentioned earlier, is that structurally, we're having a very, very hard time being able to focus on our teaching. So what should parents and high school juniors and seniors be looking for, right? So first place, I want to see universities where the professors are treated with a modicum of professional respect, where your contingent faculty is not abused, where they have some academic freedom protections. And that's a little bit kind of inside baseball and rarefied. So I'll give parents some other suggestions if that's okay with you.
Right, but on that note, how do you find that out? But that's not exactly in the brochures the website.
The problem is on the glistening website or the brochure, colleges do everything they can to mask that sort of data. Right, so you have to be very savvy and discriminating as a parent. There's some tells, by the way. I often look at course listings, right? Usually every university makes that public. And if you're seeing a lot of TBAs, right, if you're seeing a lot of classes that have 80 to 90 to 150 people in them, if you see a department where there are no tenured professors and everyone is contingent, these are really kind of siren blinking warning signs that you have to be very, very careful with this school.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so switching to the perspective of the professors,
right.
And this is important, you point out, that we understand what professors are facing, even if, you know, we have students, high school students going to college. We have to understand what professors are facing to make sure, as you put it, your kids' experience doesn't suck. So
did I say that? Oh, my God.
Put us in the shoes of a professor and tell us, what are the concerns and worries there?
So professors, when we go to graduate school, right, graduate school in the humanities takes on average 10 years. That's like twice as long as a medical school takes, or much longer. So you could learn to mend a pancreas faster than you could learn to write a peer-reviewed paper on Caravaggio or something. So you've got this 10-year process in graduate school. And the process itself is very isolating because you're usually buried in an archive somewhere. You're focusing on micro-specialized questions. And my hypothesis is that you come out of this process after 10 years formidable but defective. You're defective in terms of your ability to work with 18 to 24-year-olds, which unfortunately is precisely what the job stipulates of being an American college professor. So from the get-go, we are setting up professors to fail by not giving them any training in pedagogy during that rather awful wintry 10-year period in which they're being trained to become specialists in their area. That's where the problem begins, graduate school. I went to graduate school twice, by the way, Ben. Mm-hmm. I did two tours of duty, right, two different PhDs, and I'm struck by my imbecility, but I'm also struck by what the experience did to me in terms of my ability to just communicate with anybody, let alone an undergraduate. And I don't think my experience is in the least bit unusual.
Mm-hmm. But in your book, you say, to quote it, "I like teaching college students. More shocking still, I enjoy passing my days in the company of 18 to 24-year-olds. You call it a stunning confession for a professor. So most professors, if they don't, well, they aren't trained to teach,
right.
And so they're... they don't like to teach, most of your colleagues.
And they didn't get into it to teach, which is another really fascinating component of our vocation, right? I'd put it this way. I'm certainly not the only one. I find that on every American college campus, 10 to 25% of the faculty really cares about pedagogy, instruction, and their undergraduates. In the book, I refer to them as my people, somewhat facetiously. And I find my people everywhere. You find them at elite universities. You find them at schools ranked 3,500. What I think is starting to happen in American higher ed at the fin du siècle, as it's all imploding and it's coming apart, is many of us are starting to find one another, right? But this is as the apocalypse is setting in, right? As there are no more tenure-track jobs, as the prognosis for the future of the professorate is bleaker than it's ever been, all of a sudden these people who care about teaching are starting to connect and speak on message boards and trade industry secrets and maybe rue the day that they became academicians. So that's starting to happen, and in a way that's kind of positive.
Join our discussion with Jacques Berliner-Blau, author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our phones, Jacques, and talk with Jennifer. Jennifer, hi, what's your connection here?
Hi, so I used to be a graduate student over at Iowa State University in the evolutionary biology department. And I taught labs weekly as part of my stipend and to get a discount on my actual tuition. And our process was you had tons and tons of grad students who would once a week meet with the professor, figure out what the lessons are for the week. And then it's those graduate students who are actually doing all of the lab instruction instead of tenured professors. And at the same time, we're balancing our own research, our own classwork. And I went in loving education. Science education is my absolute passion. But it took a lot of that out of me, because you couldn't really engage with the students to the level that you would have liked, and you couldn't offer the type of education that you think these kids deserved, because they're all crammed in these classes being taught by graduate students.
Mm. Jennifer, let's get a reaction from Jacques. What's your reaction, Jacques?
Yeah, I hear that story all the time. It's interesting that she's in the sciences, right? Because I'm speaking more about the humanities, where we don't create knowledge that makes the world a better place, right? We kind of turn things over and over, right? In the STEM disciplines, I'm willing to give them a little bit of leniency or clemency on their refusal to teach, because the STEM disciplines produce knowledge that, in theory, makes the world a better place. So I think we have to distinguish STEM from the humanities. With that said, Jennifer's experience as a person who wanted to be a science educator and found her interests completely checked, blocked, stifled in graduate school, I hear that story all the time. And often the best people leave. They just decamp.
Mm, okay, let's go to another caller. James is joining us from the Quad Cities. Hi, James. What's perked your ears up about this conversation with Jacques Berliner Blau?
Hi, and thank you both for taking my call. I think that a lot of it, I love what he just said about graduate school, and I was just telling your call screener, part of graduate school, and I'm a community college professor in the Quad Cities. I teach the humanities. I teach history. If you're into teaching in graduate school as you're working on your master's and your PhD, it's almost like a scarlet letter among your peers. You don't want to admit that you really like the teaching as much or maybe more than the research. And a lot of my colleagues, and I've been teaching at a community college for 10 years now, we're sort of the ones who gravitated into that in spite of the fact that, and I think you even have advisors in graduate school who see that you're into teaching, especially in the humanities, and begin to sort of pay less attention to you and almost steer you towards, all right, well, get out of the way of my serious students who are going to do research. And I think that's one of the problems that you guys are addressing.
James, excellent that you shared your experience. And this is something very much that you cover in your book, Jacques.
Yep, I see that all the time. James works at a community college, and what I and other observers of higher ed are seeing is a lot of the creative energy in terms of pedagogy and thinking about pedagogy is emerging not from the elite schools, not from the R1s, but from the community colleges. I mean, they're very innovative, and they experiment, and a lot of the folks there actually like teaching. So that's great. One other thing I'll say is James is addressing an issue which I address in the book that we have lost. Well, we always speak about work-life balance, right? People think about that. We lost research-teaching balance as a guild, and it's destroying us. What I'm saying is there is a happy medium between producing serious scholarly research and then going back into the classroom suffused by that research and sharing it with students and then going back to the research. And somehow that loop, that balance, disappeared, and we are seeing right now what the consequences are.
Mm-hmm. And very quickly, we have less than a minute before we go to break, Jacques, but you do find excellent teaching. You talk about, for instance, small liberal arts colleges, some of them, for instance.
Yeah, so the schools that I would urge parents to look at, I do some site visits in the book. I go to some interesting places. So look at small liberal arts colleges carefully, because some of them are full of fluff. Some of them are really interesting. I also talk about honors colleges. I like honors colleges a lot because an honors college is always like the result of somebody realizing there's a big problem on campus. So they carve something out to address it.
Okay, Jacques Berliner Blau is with us. We'll take a short break and be back with the author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Join us with your experience. Former college students, parents of college students, professors, 1-866-780-9100. Do you agree with what you're hearing? Do you have an observation? 1-866-780-9100. When I come back, I want to delve more into tenure. What is tenure? Where did it come from? What are the reasons? And who does it serve? I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer talking about higher education this hour. some critical examination of it by my guest, Jacques Berliner Blau. He's a tenured professor himself at Georgetown University, professor and director of the Center for Jewish Civilization there. His book, Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. We're inviting you to join our conversation. We have plenty of people wanting to chime in, Jacques, and we'll get to them in just a moment. 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. It's worth pointing out, Jacques, as we talk a little bit about tenure, that would you be writing this book? Would you have written this book without being a tenured professor?
Incomprehensible. There are just too many trade secrets and divulgences. No, there's just no way I could have written this book.
You needed that protection.
I needed that protection.
Okay. You're saying the tenure system is falling apart. A lot of our listeners are hazy on tenure if they know what it is. Remind us, what is tenure? What are the reasons for tenure? Who does it serve?
Yeah, well, tenure came into being in 1940 when two groups, the American Association of University Professors, they're known as the AAUP, and the Association of American Colleges, kind of issued a statement about, what do they call it, Statement of Principles on Academic Freedom and Tenure. AAUP, by the way, Ben, AAUP is good people. They have fought hard for the professorate, but I just think that we're in the final stage here. In any case, the idea was a lot of loudmouth professors on the left and the right, as early as right after the Civil War, through World War I, up until the Second World War, were expressing their hot takes in the classroom and outside of the classroom and kind of being thrown out on their keisters for their efforts. And this was happening way too frequently, that somebody would say something unpopular and a trustee would get mad or a politician and they'd be gone. That's how tenure as we know it comes into being, the fear that these professors are just disappearing from these positions because they upset somebody who is powerful or wealthy.
Well, how is it different than a corporation or a business? People working in, you know, listeners are saying, well, you know, if I don't perform the way my boss wants it, I'll go out on my keister too. Why should it be different in higher ed?
But it's not a performance question. It's an opinion question, right? So you have professors who were in very good standing, who were doing everything they were supposed to be doing. We're not talking about the Deadwood. That's another large category which we can get to. We're talking about professors that were doing everything they should be doing as professors, but they were saying things that were unpopular, be it pro-communist worldview or isolationist agitprop. Whatever it might be, it was unpopular and someone didn't like it and they were losing their jobs.
Okay. So you point out in your book in the 1970s, over 50% were tenured or tenured-track professors in the country. Today, it's half that. Well, what's the problem with that? Why is that a problem?
Well, the first thing that goes out the window is academic freedom, right? And that's a real frightful scenario for a certain type of professor. The STEM disciplines, they're doing great. I'm not worried about them. But if you work in literature, cinema, women's studies, anthropology, sociology, political science, right? The combustive potential of what you say in the classroom, should you choose to say interesting things in your classroom, is immense. And there are always people on the left and the right that are looking to get rid of you. And tenure is what protects some of us, those of us who are on the tenure line, from their interventions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to our callers. Jacques, we have a lot of interest in this conversation. I'll ask all of our callers to get to the point, be as concise as possible so we can get as many callers, different perspectives in to bounce off Jacques, author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. Let's go to Iowa City. Tom is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, you've been listening to Jacques. Is it something you want to chime in on?
Yes, I have. Very, very provocative, and I'm glad you didn't ask for my last name because I'd probably get in a lot of trouble for what I'm going to say, but no, not really. There's a lot of things that I could respond to, but I will get to the a point. And that tenure, even in the STEM disciplines where I'm at, is a really valuable thing if used correctly. And at a critical point in my career, shortly after I got tenure, I started to a collaboration with somebody that was pretty far outside of my discipline. And there was a period of time, about, you know, 3 or 4 years, where, you know, my publications in my primary area of research really dropped off before they picked up again in this interdisciplinary area. And if I hadn't had tenure, I probably would have been out. So it really, you know, it actually has a usefulness even within the STEM disciplines, where he seems to think that we're kind of an exception to this. I would also point out the thing about teaching, that in engineering, at least, you know, here at Iowa, most of the undergraduates are taught by tenured professors, and it may be that the students aren't aware of that, but most of the undergraduate courses are taught by tenured faculty. It's been that way for a long time, although it's changing, and the reason it's changing mostly just has to do with funding, that the state is not funding the university the way it was, and we don't have as many tenured faculty lines. And so we've actually been forced to start defining roles for instructors. And I'm really happy to say that at Iowa, we've actually put in place procedures that actually treat instructors and these faculty as first-class citizens. They get to participate in most other faculty activities as well as just as teaching and lecturing.
Okay. Tom in Iowa City, thanks for your view. Faculty member at the University of Iowa. 1-866-780-9100. We're trying to rapid fire through a lot of perspectives here. Jacques Berliner Blau drumming up a lot of interest with his book, Campus Confidential. Jan is with us from Atlantic. Hi, Jan. What do you want to say?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, first of all, I'm not teaching right now. I taught for 10 years in community college as an adjunct, had no desire to go toward tenure. It was a part-time job. At the same time, any of the preparation for the syllabus for each semester, all of the training that was required, that we keep up with digital demands from higher education to help students who had special needs, such as blind students and whatnot, took at least 15 hours of classes and 40 hours and beyond to stay current, to know this, how to do this, these digital formulas, software, whatnot, in order to stay current. None of this was ever paid for. None of our preparation time was ever paid for. Not a penny.
Okay.
And if you care about teaching, and I did, I mean, that's asking way too much of people.
Okay, Jan, we want to get a reaction from Jacques, perhaps to Jan or the previous caller, Jacques. What are you thinking when you hear these things?
Well, vis-a-vis Jan, there's a bottomlessness to teaching where every good teacher knows that theoretically you could spend infinite amounts of hours just teaching one class. And she's absolutely correct about how much, when there's the slightest change in technology, how much that shunts the responsibility on us. One thing Jan brings up, which I feel people misunderstand this about American professors, we have a reputation as being lazy, right? I use that term deadwood. Sure, that exists. But in my experience, that is not the case. I mean, we're crazy, but we're not lazy. If people knew how hard American professors work, generally on their research, not so much their teaching, unfortunately, I think they would vomit. I don't think there's another profession out there, especially given how we're remunerated, that people put in so much time on the weekends during the summer. I'd just like to redirect all that energy towards a horizon that better serves undergraduates and maybe serves us better.
Okay, you mentioned it before, Jacques. Talk about the deadwood, because that is what you were addressing before. People have this common concession of lazy. There is a, I don't know, what would you put the percentage at? A certain percentage of professors who are tenured know that they have incredible job security, and their lack of performance shows it.
Yeah, them. They're usually at the rank of associate and, to a lesser extent, full professor. They're pretty rare. They're there. They're kind of lovable in their own way, and they appear in every campus novel you've ever read. I mean, they're great source material for fictional explorations of the dysfunctional professorate. They're there. What's interesting, if we can move this back to policy for a second, Ben, is public universities are getting extremely adept at rooting them out and getting rid of them. So University of Tennessee, I believe, has introduced something called detenurification. So there are these new processes at public schools precisely to find these people and to put them out to pasture, which might not be the worst thing in the world as long as it's done in a reasonable manner. But for the most part, I want to stress, professors work very, very, very hard.
Detenurification. No, I didn't get that quite right, did I? Anyway, what about tenure as a whole, the future of it? It's trending down. Will it disappear at some point?
Some of the prognosis is that it won't exist in 20 years. Some people believe it'll only exist at elite schools, and others feel that it will blip down to about 10%, 20% of the overall professorate. So what is to be done? In the book, I do have some suggestions. I'll say one thing. Here's the problem, and I have benefited from tenure. So I'm pro-tenure, right? But the problem is that tenure is no longer serving the majority of scholars and the majority of undergraduates. So fewer and fewer scholars have tenure or will even ever have a chance to get on the tenure line. And the system so incentivizes professors to prioritize research over teaching that it's not serving undergraduates. So what am I missing here, Ben? Right? Something has got to give. Well, it's giving already. We're seeing something has got to change, except we don't really have the leadership structures in place in American higher education to get us out of this quagmire. I mean, we're just sinking in quicksand here, and there's no way out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what would be your way out if you could dictate the way forward?
This is a very unpopular way forward. I have a long section on a new emerging growth sector for the professorate, and it's called full-time non-tenure track. What does that mean? That means you won't be subjected to those awful, deplorable working conditions. You won't be on the tenure line either, but you will have a modicum of professional respect granted towards you. You will have some job security. You will have full academic freedoms and a somewhat decent salary. So I'd like to make that category expand in negotiation with universities and say, well, if you're going to get rid of these tenure lines, we want more decent-paying, beautiful American jobs for more scholars. If we're going to get rid of tenure, we have to at least expand this other category that is full-time non-tenure track. That's not ideal. I'd rather that we go back to the 70s levels where we were about 47, 48% of folks were on the tenure line. But I think those days have passed.
Okay. If you just joined us, Jacques Berliner-Blau is with us, author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. We have about 10 minutes left. We want to get into, and I see on my screen that Kurt does too, get into the politics involved with higher education. Hi, Kurt. In Davenport, what specifically do you want to talk about as we talk a little bit about politics in higher education?
Yes, thank you, Ben. I'm curious to hear your guest take on the new polling numbers that came out within the last couple of weeks that indicate conservative members of this country tend to look disfavorably upon higher education and a perceived lack of political diversity. And specifically, I'm curious if your guest sees this as an issue, considering that here in Iowa and in a majority of other states, you have Republican majorities in the legislatures, which therefore they control a large, have a large amount of control over budgetary, funding for, regions, universities, et cetera.
Okay, Kurt, in Davenport, very good. Let me add before you jump in here, Jacques, this past legislative session, to add on to what Kurt said there, an Iowa State Senator, Mark Shelgren, proposed a state law to require state universities to seek ideological balance among faculty members during the hiring process. So comment on that and Kurt's question there.
First of all, Kirk should get like a T-shirt or something, because that's a great question. He's speaking about this recent Pew poll that came out, that something like 60% of Republicans or leaning Republican independents don't think that the universities and colleges of America are having a good effect on the country. It's a huge problem. And my friends on the left, which is most of the people I know in higher education, I think aren't really thinking carefully about what this is doing to us. And Kirk raised the key issue, right? How many state houses in the country are Republican-controlled, right? Republicans, for whatever reasons, and actually there are some really good reasons, I want to be honest, right, have this impression that the professoriate, particularly in the liberal arts, is militantly against them, is radically liberal or far left, and does not share their concerns in any way, shape, or form. And there's some scholarly books that unfortunately indicate precisely that, at least in terms of the voting preferences of the American professorate. So it almost is like a natural reflex that they start defunding these great public university systems. I'm thinking of North Carolina. I'm thinking of Arizona. I'm thinking of Florida. I'm thinking of Wisconsin. I'm thinking of Iowa. So whether you agree with this or not, the perception is there And it's creating a tremendous amount of havoc for public universities in the United States. And I want to go further, even though I'm not really a conservative. I think conservative critics of the humanities in particular, I think they have a reasonable point. I mean, their worldview is so completely marginalized on the typical humanities faculty, especially the elite humanities faculty, that it's patently noticeable. I do have a long piece in the Washington Post about who's where and who's doing what, but we can talk about that.
Let's talk about that. We have a few minutes left. This recent piece for the Washington Post headlined, "When Your Next College Free Speech Controversy Erupts, Don't Blame Liberals." Mm-hmm. What points did you make in that recent piece?
Folks, when they look at higher education, tend to think of it like American political culture, where we're red, blue, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican. They'd be better off thinking in terms of not a binary, but a tripartite split. There are actually three camps on your typical liberal arts faculty. So a tiny, tiny group of conservatives who are usually embattled, right, and usually of very high quality, I would add. A larger group of graying liberals. I'd probably put myself in there, though I like to be a little bit unpredictable. And a much more influential group of what we might call the radical left. And those folks are very serious scholars. I will never take that away from them. Just for whatever reasons, they have this outsized presence on every elite humanities faculty in the United States. And the radical left and liberals do not share a lot of common ground on basic philosophical issues, on issues of public policy, and in particular on issues of free speech. Liberals don't like trigger warnings. They don't think much of safe spaces. We tend to really resent speaker boycotts of any sort. And I see kind of intellectual energy for those sorts of initiatives coming from the radical left, but not from liberals. So the title of the piece was "Don't Blame Liberals for These Types of Ructions That Are Occurring on College Campuses." Liberals are generally, historically, kind of free speech fundamentalists. I think liberals invent the idea, if you want to go back to John Locke and move the tradition forward. So we have to be careful as to who we're blaming for all the really serious free speech controversies we're having on campus today.
What about this idea of seeking a state senator in Iowa trying to seek through law ideological balance in universities?
You know, I wish it didn't come to that, but there are groups like Heterodox Academy, which is a very interesting group of scholars, where they're making basically the same argument. They're saying we need viewpoint diversity. I would agree. I just don't know how you enforce viewpoint diversity. My preference, I want to be very clear about this, Ben, I like a professor whose politics are either inscrutable or completely unpredictable. All right, that's my preference in a professor. I hate to think that here are the liberals and here are the conservatives. Right. So my favorite professors were men and women who I could not figure out politically, because they were following a different logic, and it was the logic of their disciplinary field of inquiry, whatever that might have been. So I'd like to create a fourth camp, right? The professors who are inscrutable. You have no idea what they might say, not because they're not coherent or crazy, but because they're complex, and they think about the world in very, very different apolitical ways, or ways that don't conduce to simple political categories.
Okay, let's go to what will have to be our last caller, Fred in Ankeny. Hi, Fred, not much time. What point do you want to make? What question do you have?
I'll be real quick. I'm retired now. I've taken the last 4 years, and I've taken math classes at both Iowa State, DMAC, and around just because I can. And here's the problem. I actually get down into the classrooms of these people, and many of the teachers who teach this thing are from foreign countries. And you cannot understand their English, and like differential equations is hard enough to learn without being able to understand the language. And I'm just wondering, why can't we put some sort of requirement that cause these people to be able to speak? That's my point.
Mm. Okay, Fred and Ankeny. Jacques, you want to react to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I really wish those jobs weren't going to graduate students. I've studied a lot of languages. I love when people speak differently. I learn more about English when I hear a non-English speaker. So I have no problem with that per se, but I understand what his concern is. The question to me is, why do we have so many graduate students in STEM and in the humanities doing the work that, in theory, we're paying the tenure line professors to do, right? Mm-hmm. To my way of seeing things, the tenure line professors should be doing the lion's share of the teaching because they're being paid quite well and they're being guaranteed lifetime job security. So as a point of honor, as a point of pride, a tenure line professor should be in the classroom slogging away with undergraduates.
Okay, we have just over a minute left. Leave us with, sort of wrap it up if you can, Jacques, also for those who joined us later in the program. Leave us with some important questions, perhaps, that you think higher ed needs to consider right now.
Yeah, first question is, how can we reconfigure the tenure system so it does serve scholars and students? Who is going to stand up for the humanities? We seem to know what went wrong. Can we start implementing solutions to some of the wrong turns that we've taken along the way? And the final thing I'll say is to the professors out there who like to teach, I'm at my happiest when I'm teaching, and I find other scholars like that, and I wish there'd be more of us or more people would feel empowered to come out and say, I really like teaching. I like being with those 18 to 24-year-old schnooks, right? That's where I live, right? That's where my life is made. And I think the professorate will benefit greatly when more of us adopt that type of enthusiasm for the classroom and for the students in the classroom.
As you said before, restoring what you see as a better research-teaching balance.
Right.
Jacques Berliner-Blau, we've run out of time. A lot of interest in your topic. Thank you for joining us this hour. Author of Campus Confidential, How College Works or Doesn't for Professors, Parents, and Students. There's a lot more in this book than we could cover, obviously, during this hour. Jacques Berliner-Blau of Georgetown University, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much. That was fun.
All right. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.